This is myth four. And we are coming to both a conclusion and a continuity at the same time. Let's review for just a moment the kinds of structure that are occurring constantly, and just consciously come in and note this structural pattern for a while. Our excursions into education are the form of an inquiry, and our inquiry is being given a graded pace, a rhythm, if you will, so that the pace of the inquiry achieves a kind of energy. Any periodicity introduced into momentum is an energy. And the periodicity that we're introducing here is a pace of coming every Saturday. And so we have a weekly pace. And this weekly pace is an ancient pace of keeping track of experience so that experience can eventually transform into personal time. The transformation of tribal experience into personal time requires at least a weekly pacing. Tribal experience can have a pace based on the moon or based on the sun, a solar or lunar quality, the seasons, the months. But when one brings together an experience where one transforms out of the tribal culture into the personal historical, you need a finer calibration than the year or the month. You need at least, minimally, a weekly pacing. So that the cycle of the Sabbath, every seventh day, is not a superstitious cycle, but the cycle of the Sabbath is a way of generating a personal time, a personal historicity, out of a cultural experience milieu. So our energy sine wave is established by every Saturday. Our Saturdays are again the Sabbath. When I was a boy, Saturday mornings in America were always playtime on the radio. Little boys during the Second World War would cluster around watching their radio and listen to Jack Armstrong or listen to Sky King, dying to get the address you could send in to get your special ring from Sky King. So Saturday morning was American boys' playtime, but it was also, in ancient times, the time when one heard the Torah. One did not read it straight through, but one heard a section. And those audio sections of hearing the Torah every Sabbath lasted for a 3-year cycle. It was called the lectionary cycle. So in a way, the ancient quality of weekly sacred time merges with the play element. The play element of an American culture that has nothing to do with any one tradition, but has to do with a mulching together of all traditions. And so we have a planetary sense here of play and sacred at the same time. And so our coming every Saturday establishes this kind of energy sine wave, the weekly sine wave, the 7-day cycle, And that weekly 7-day cycle groups itself into fours, very naturally around a moon, a lunar cycle. But it also groups itself into 12s very easily around a seasonal cycle. So that if you went into a deep archetypal structure of profound symbolic form, you would find that fours and sevens and 12s always go together. They make a matrix. If you read the book of Revelation, the Apocalypse of John, you would find the symbolism generates all of its meaning around fours, sevens, and 12s. So they go together. They have a quality. Implicit in this fours, sevens, and 12s is a quality of three, which is hidden. If you take a single four and add a single three, you get a seven. If you take a four and divide it into 12, you get a three. If you take a seven and subtract a four, you get a three. So threes, triads, triplets, triangles, cubes, 2 to the 3rd power is 8. These kinds of qualities creep into the structure of 4, 7, and 12. So this kind of numerical quantifying of a structure is deeply symbolic. And when we get to symbols, we'll talk more about this. We'll talk about how there is a mathematique to ideas, that ideas are profoundly mathematical, not in their content so much as in the very structure by which they can be delivered so that they are recognizable. Something that is cognizable is perceptual, but something that is recognizable is conceptual. The difference between perception and conception is that the structure becomes integrated to the content. In perception, you only need to have the content. But in conception, you have to have the structure as well as the content integrated. In ancient symbolic society, when the Neolithic was transforming into the symbolic, it was so very difficult. One of the great teachers, one of the great educators of that whole era was Pythagoras. And Pythagoras had a very simple way of making distinctions for people to follow themselves. You were not put into classes of students, but you distributed yourself into those classes. And the first class was silence. Do not use the language you're used to. The language that you're used to, your natural language, your cultural language, is no longer to be brought into play. Yes, you can use it, but not here, not now. So that the initial learning situation was that you were among the silent. But paired with the silence was the ability to hear someone else, someone who would use the voice, their voice, use speaking language in a measured way, so that those who were silent were called akousmatiki, akousmatic. One could hear, but one could not speak. So the akousmatiki were the first level. And that lasted usually 5 years. After 5 years of being tuned, so that your hearing was tuned, not only does hearing become tuned, but it's like the yogic principle. Whenever any perceptual quality becomes ordered, all of the other perceptions become sensitized and amenable to the order. So when the hearing became ordered, the seeing also became ordered. not associatively, so that the ear and the eye are related in a connection of ear and eye, but the ear to the brain and then the brain to the eye. So that the brain, when it becomes ordered in some perceptual mode, becomes capable of then ordering the other perceptual modes. So the akousmatiki were followed by the mathematiki. And the mathematiki were those who could see. They could make the gestalts of the patterns of meaning that were generated by the energy, the graded energy of the language. Because when you can hear, it's like little boys during the Second World War got tremendous imaginations because they learned to hear. They learned to hear stories in their flow. They learned to carry the sets of descriptiveness that became characters embedded in a flow of a narrative, of an adventure. And it produced a tremendous imaginative quality. Children raised on radio had a tremendous imagination. Children raised on television have a tremendous memory. The atrophying of the imagination is noticeable. So that there is a quality, when you hear stories, imagination is spurred. And when you see stories, memory is spurred. So that the akousmatiki became capable of tremendous imagination, and then the development of the mathematiki cycle developed the ability of memory. And once you have imagination and memory both, then you have the focus which makes consciousness tremendously viable in the universe. And it's like perception and conception together, when they're both capable of being focused together. It's like a mathematical quality of the tensor. One has a relational field of energized capability which can be tapped. So that our education is not only a development of a weekly cycle giving us an energy, but we're penetrating into a field of inquiry that's generating while we're going into it. The more we go into this field of inquiry, the richer becomes this field of inquiry. And it's an old transformational principle which nature has perfected. If you keep a steady, refined direction, and you keep enriching the field in which that direction is penetrating, there will come a saturation point where the field is saturated enough or supersaturated enough so that the direction of energy precipitates out a new form, a transformation. A new constellation will come out, triggered by the steadiness of the refining fire, but constituted by all of the enriched elements in the field of inquiry that can constellate together. The constellation of the new self-selects, self-organizes whatever can go together, so that there's a mystery to integration. One never knows exactly what's going to come out, except that if you enrich the field of inquiry with enough real juice, enough real content, everything that can go together will go together into a new gestalt, will precipitate out as a new constellation. And whatever that is, that will be the goal. And so our education is this kind of a pattern. This pattern of our dedication, of just plowing through steadily, keeping the refining fire lit, of just every Saturday, keeping that ritual comportment, and at the same time, enriching the field of inquiry, introducing more and more material, more and more items, more and more functions coming up. So that the whole first year of our education is to establish a supersaturated field of inquiry that has all kinds of directions happening. In that field of inquiry, there are four major directions, vectors, structural arcs that need to be developed, along with all the other content, along with all the other relationalities and associations. It's like strands. It's like the stranding quality. It's like the phosphate-backed sugar quality of a DNA strand or an RNA strand. It needs to have some kind of a cue, an organizing cue, so that all of the integration can happen. It's like the spinal column integrates the nervous system. And so in the embryo, the spinal column is one of the first things that begins to develop. Our spinal column and our first year of education are the development of four strands of motion. One of them is the strand of nature. One of them is the strand of ritual. A third now is the strand of myth. And a fourth would be the strand of symbols. And we're making it archetypal. We're making each of these four strands correspond to a season, so that the whole first year is actually a year of education. It's a ritual year. It's a ceremonial year. But it's a ceremonial year of a tribe like ours, which is planetary. Our culture is planetary. We're no longer Greeks or Chinese or Jews or Iranians or Mayans. Our tribe, our culture, is the whole planet. We have a planetary culture. So that the individual, the personal history that comes out of this will be a precipitation out of a constellation of the entire planet. We will be at home in whatever culture there was, or is, or will be. But as we will see, starting in a couple of months, a culture transforms into a civilization. And the civilization is always a higher order, is one order higher than the culture. And so a civilization, which is a transformational gestalt, it's a constellation that comes after transformation. When a culture transforms, it transforms into a civilization. Culture is the caterpillar, the civilization is the butterfly. The tribal person is the caterpillar, the conscious person is the butterfly. The Greek word, psyche, psyche, meant butterfly. The spirit, which is able to fly free in the differential conscious air, was one time a cocoon, and before that cocoon was a caterpillar in a culture, in a tribe. So one needs to go through that entire ecology, that entire process. So the coming every Saturday establishes an energy momentum. The only function of doing it on a weekly basis is to establish an energy momentum in terms that links up to structures that are available in fours, sevens, twelves, and threes. And once we have that, we can make all kinds of relationalities. We can do many things. At the same time, we're enriching our field of inquiry. So what becomes constellated later on in the transformation is enriched enormously. And just as the synthesizing threads of nature and ritual and myth and symbol are four distinct and quite different processes to bring them together in an integral cycle, links them all together so that you have a single arc wreathing itself around. Now, when language began to be discursive enough and a vocabulary fine enough to talk about spiritual things, the form of language was that of the hymn. And the hymn is a wreathing of language around a synthesizing thread that brings an integral whole into constellation. This kind of language is an ancient language. The first indications that we have of this kind of language go back to about 2500, 2700 BC, in that era. The first half of the third millennium BC. Those first languages that are wreathed hymns sometimes are called, from a 19th century holdover anthropological outlook, they're called spells, the magic spells. But a magic spell is like a conscious poem. It's meant to weave an energy and a dynamic together. It's meant to bring an imagery into an integration so that it has a symbolic core. That symbolic core is its focus. And once you give a focus to a language form, it's amenable to transformation. Once it has a focal core, a language form can be transformed. It can be changed. So that the sacredness of a hymn, a wreathed language form, is that it's capable of transformation. Now, if a human being, if a man or a woman, interiorizes those language forms so that those hymns become a part of your interior world, that your imaginative capacity, your imagination is structured by those hymns, structured by the cycle of those spells, linked to the movement of the myths, made into a whole of that mythology. When those language forms find their focuses, and those focuses constellate into a large gestalt, and that gestalt transforms, it carries with it everything that belongs to it, including our interior world. Just as the language forms, finding their focus and share that focus into a gestalt which transforms, that transformation takes our inner world with it. Our whole sense of experience and feeling and meaning also transforms, using the tool of language to do this, using the tool of language to interiorize, and then making language symbolic and having symbolic language transform into a vision. Magic is a vision. Consciousness is a vision. It's a seeing. It's a seeing not with the eyes. It's a seeing of wholenesses. If someone works a meditation long enough so that you can get a pure quality of innerness, so that you lose the habitual ritual comportment of focusing the two eyes to a point. If one sees within, in an inner sense, one does not see points, one sees allness. Inner seeing is allness. It's the entirety of the gestalt. It's the wholeness. One sees in terms of wholes. So when one looks then with visionary conscious eyes, one sees resonances of wholeness rather than pointillism. And this turns out to be a major step in development, in evolution, in humanness. One of the pairs of books that we will take next time, Ruth Benedict, marvelous anthropologist, Ruth Benedict's Patterns of Culture. and Ruth Benedict's Patterns of Culture, she will write in here about the need to look at wholeness. She's one of the first writers to really emphasize this kind of quality. Her anthropological work was one of the first developments of the conscious need to bring wholeness, gestalts, into play, and not to let it devolve into pointillistic separateness of individual items. She writes in here, page 51, the chapter is The Integration of Culture, Patterns of Culture. The gestalt, the configuration, psychology, gestalt psychology, kind of new at the time when she's writing this in the 1930s, 1934, first edition. The gestalt psychology has done some of the most striking work in justifying the importance of this point of departure from the whole rather than from its parts. Gestalt psychologists have shown that in the simplest sense perception, no analysis of the separate percepts can account for the total experience. The whole is greater than the sum of the parts, by a lot. For one thing, just as one could logically atomize parts, the logic of analysis applies equally not only to the atomization of parts, but to the atomization of relationalities. Relationals are just as important as points. And so minimally, one would have to have as many relational items as there are points in a complete inventory of just the parts. Whereas the whole includes many things, many items, resonances, echoes, correspondences, which are not there in lists of relationalities or points, no matter how detailed. So she's writing, Ruth Benedict writing, about 60 years ago now. Gestalt psychologists have shown that in the simplest sense perception, no analysis of the separate percepts can account for the total experience, because quite frequently, a simple indication serves as the whole. What's that? There isn't anybody in this room that doesn't see a cat. There's no cat there. We have a gestalt seeing which is trained by our experience in the world, and nature has already given us gestalts long before and in much more comprehension than any listing of points. One of the most interesting things that an advanced yogi discovers is that the catalog of perceptual points available to him is infinite, and the list is unending. One can see accurately to the nth degree, and the nth degree is ever refined. Because the list of points in a physics text now goes down below the atoms into subatomic structure indefinitely, and into subquark structure also rather indefinitely. So this whole assumption that one can simply list the points and on that logical basis build up the whole is rather naive. In fact, it's a colossal error. It has nothing to do with the viable procedure of intelligence which you would expect to engender from an education. Here's the remaining part of this paragraph from Ruth Benedict. Gestalt psychology have shown the simplest sense perception. No analysis of the separate percepts can account for the total experience. It is not enough to divide perceptions into objective fragments. The subjective framework, the forms provided by past experience, are crucial and cannot be omitted. The wholeness properties, the wholeness tendencies must be studied in addition to the simple association mechanisms with which psychology has been satisfied since the time of Locke. We talked a little bit a couple of weeks ago about Locke's essay on human understanding and how even at that time, a superior logical mathematical mind like Leibniz issued a 600-page critique of Locke's on human understanding. Unfortunately, it wasn't published until 300 years after it was written. It laid on a dusty shelf. In fact, most of Leibniz's great writings laid on dusty shelves in a library in Europe for hundreds of years, unpublished. The bulk of Leibniz is still unpublished. It's a curiosity of history. Leibniz was the great Hermetic magus and master of the end of the 17th century, the 1600s, and he was positioned by development and design to be the magician advisor in the court of the king who was to make a new world. Only the king was King George, the House of Hanover, who went from Germany to become the King of England. And England became the world British Empire because of this whole development. The fusing of the German and the English traditions together produced a world empire, the British Empire. And Leibniz, instead of being taken along with George, was left because George identified Leibniz as a trouble causer because he not only taught his wife, Charlotte, to think, but he taught his daughter Sophia also to think. And thinking women bothered George no end. This band was responsible, so he is left behind in Germany. And all his material are not going to be published. They're not going to be translated into English, and they weren't. And so a lot of the peculiar, blocky stuffiness of the British Empire mentality, the stiff upper lip without the structural subconscious to really go with it, was left behind. That's another story. A deep education is a humiliating quality. One understands that most of this world is just a scam. It's a welter instead of a Weltanschauung. It's a welter of scams, a welter scam. The Hollywood trickster knows this and escapes. The whole determines its parts. Back to Ruth Benedict for a moment. The whole determines its parts, not only their relation, but their very nature. The nature of the whole. What's going to resonate is out of the whole. Forms resonate. The atoms of iron in a bell resonate together, but when they're brought together into the shape of the bell and you ring the bell's resonance is in the shape of the bell, not the iron atoms. The acoustical echo shape is that of a bell. And if one picked up the resonance of a bell, you would get the shape of that bell in the resonant energy waves. The sound is in the shape of the bell. So that when a human personality is really integrated, the resonance of that person is in the shape of the person, not in the shapes of the chemicals and various atomic structures that go to make up their body. It's not even in the shape of the body so much, it's in the shape of the person. This next year, because we'll see that our education, which has an annual cycle of integration, needs to be complemented by an annual cycle of differentiation. There's a whole cycle of differentiation that goes with and complements integration. And just as we're looking at nature, ritual, myth, and symbol as an integral ecology, that integral ecology, once integrated, has a resonance, has a conscious field, which has its own ecology. It has its own four-part development. It has vision and art and history and science. And one ends up with such objective entities as a person and a cosmos. But the person and the cosmos do not occur in the integral cycle at all. They are not integration forms at all. You hear a lot of glib teachers, prophets, and reformers talking about integrating the personality. It never happened. There's no such beast. A personality is a differential form of consciousness. You yourself, who have brought up children and have talked to teenagers, know that human beings that don't differentiate very well are trouble causers. They're not really all there. It takes a while for them to get used to the differential qualities of their own person. And then we say of them, well, they're starting to grow up. They're getting out of the tribal habituated preferences and into their personal design. This is a whole different thing. So that someone like Ruth Benedict here, and we shouldn't assume that just because we're talking about a female American anthropologist that she's somewhat naive. We talked about this before, about how a whole generation of American women were trained, like Gladys Reichardt, Ruth Benedict, Margaret Mead. There are many of them, about a dozen or more. And many of them were trained by Franz Boas. And Franz Boas came from Germany and brought with him a tremendous, cultivated, ideational, powerful intellectual understanding and apparatus. So the very next paragraph concerns Wilhelm Dilthey. Dilthey, whose works on culture and history, the history of ideas, the development of conscious civilizations out of integrated cultures, are only now being translated into English in a systematic way. Princeton University Press has brought out 2 volumes of the collected works of Dilthey in English, 100 years after they were read profusely in a cultivated Europe. Dilthey was of the same generation as Friedrich Nietzsche. And Nietzsche and Dilthey belong together, and the power of that intellectual tradition in Europe at the end of the 19th century is incomprehensible without pairing Dilthey with Nietzsche. They go together extremely well. And whereas the vision of Nietzsche was that of the wild consciousness of the open person, Dilthey was of the wild consciousness of the differential cosmos. There's a lot to be learned. Education can go very far, but we have to build. What are we building? We're building a sensitivity to an enriched field of inquiry that will culminate in a transformation, and that transformation will carry with us whatever our language forms are able to focus and constellate together. So we're hunting big game. We're like old Paleolithic men and women who are wise to the Neolithic men and women who preferred, instead of to follow wild nature exclusively, preferred to tame nature and make new forms that were never seen in nature, something supernatural. But we are also learning that there is a whole symbolic level of culture, that the Paleolithic and the Neolithic has also a symbolic quality. And that symbolic quality comes when language forms begin to wreathe themselves so that they have focuses. One still has a very perfect image of that whole process from archaic times. If one looks at a tarot deck, and you look at the major arcana of the tarot deck, the last trump card in the tarot deck shows the wreath and shows the goddess of freedom, of liberté, stepping through the wreath, the world card. The world is only a trump when it's integrated into an index form that fits into a whole other ecology which is required, a complementation. A major arcana without a minor arcana makes a very poor tarot deck. And the fact that the minor deck, the minor arcana, the bulk of those cards, arrange themselves in a four-part sequence. We talked about it somewhat with the From Ritual to Romance, Jesse L. Weston. Before we had Inanna and Jane Ellen Harrison's Prolegomena to the Study of Greek Religion as the pair of books that we're using. Before that, we had Jesse L. Weston and Basho's Narrow Road to the Deep North, From Ritual to Romance and the Narrow Road to the Deep North. The origins of the Grail Quest and its generation of tarot deck major arcana symbols, and Basho and the development of the haiku poetic form. If you have a poetic form in Neolithic times changing to symbolic times, say 5,000 years ago, a poetic form that specializes in looking at the wreathing so that focus is capable, it's not surprising that some 4,500 years later, someone in Japan, especially a Japanese genius, would write a poetic form that fit the focus rather than the wreath. And a haiku is the focus of a language form. So if you take a constellation of haiku, you have, in refined, super, ultimate, pared-down Japanese technology, a constellation of haiku is the transformative node, is the way in which one can carry one's interiorization into a differential way. Shortcut, Vajrayana. A haiku is like a Vajrayana version of the old poetic hymns. It's the focus, it's the center instead of the circle. And no one has done it better than Basho. Let's, before the break, take a look at an example. The classic example, the classic haiku. Notice how Basho does not just present the haiku, but he presents the experience, the soup, the stew, the flow of inquiry enriched. So the prose preceding the haiku, and then the haiku. There was a temple called Rushikuji in the province of Yamagata, founded by the great priest Jikaku. This temple was known for the absolute tranquility of its holy compound. Since everybody advised me to see it, I changed my course at Obanazawa and went there, though it meant walking an extra 7 miles or so. When I reached it, the late afternoon sun was still lingering over the scene. After arranging to stay with the priest at the foot of the mountain, I climbed to the temple situated near the summit. The whole mountain was made of massive rocks thrown together and covered with age-old pines and oaks. The stony ground itself bore the color of eternity, paved with velvety moss. The doors of the shrines built on the rocks were firmly barred, and there was not a sound to be heard. As I moved on all fours now, from rock to rock, crawling, bowing reverently at each shrine, I began to feel the purifying power of this holy environment pervading my whole being. In utter silence of an old temple, a cicada's voice, solitary, penetrates the rocks. We're coming back to myth four. We're talking about Ruth Benedict. We're talking about patterns of culture. We're talking about how gestalts are more than the parts, and that this making of the gestalt is a very precarious procedure. A gestalt does not constellate itself properly until you participate with it. You have to participate with the flow in order for a gestalt to come into being. You cannot just mimic the relationalities and remember the parts. This makes for a very, very bad situation. You can block out a play accurately, and you can have actors who remember the parts perfectly. But that alone, in that combination, will not produce a dramatic experience. It has to play well. The blocked out movements and the remembered lines have to work together in something called the play. The play's the thing. And when it's done right, it's totally transforming. If you have ever seen any play done dramatically right, wherever you see that play again, you will be a very good critic about why it didn't work in some other rendition or why it does work in another rendition. I once saw here in Los Angeles a long time ago, Tennessee Williams' Camino Real, with young Earl Holliman as Kilroy. And it was a fabulous performance. And one got the surreal, romantic, surreal quality of Tennessee Williams to the nth degree, when the Mark Tabor Forum was new. And one was completely mesmerized because you participated in it. So this participation is essential. The participation in this education is essential. And the more that you do, the higher the gradient of your participation and the more that the flow of the gestalt cinches and takes place. Your participation is an essential ingredient in the enrichment of the field of inquiry. When we're talking about patterns of culture, we're talking about something which is not just one culture that has its pattern. We're talking about several different cultures, or many different cultures, that have their patterns that interplay. For instance, Ruth Benedict takes three different cultures. And we'll see, we'll spend a whole month using Ruth Benedict's patterns of culture and paired with it, Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. We'll take these two books and pair them together because this stage of our presentation of myth is a development from the stage where Jane Ellen Harrison's Prolegomena and Diane Volkstein's translation of Inanna go together. If you take this pair, Jane Ellen Harrison and Inanna, and you put this pair next to the pair of Ruth Benedict and Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, you get a square. You get a pair of pairs, and you get a square. Squares are always stable. And when you have a square like this, it sets up for the first time what can be called a matrix. The pair of pairs, the square, is the first matrix. It's the first matrix structure. out of which can come any degree of complexity that one would wish to have. Just like a binary language of one and zero can generate every computer language there is, a square with its matrix structural capacities can generate not only every geometry that there is, but every trigonometric functional sphericality that there is. One of the fundamental things then in our education is that as we move along, we're constantly making new possibilities for new squares. When we introduce Ruth Benedict and Sir Gawain and the Green Knight next week for the first time, we'll take a look at a new pair that juxtaposed to the first pair that of myth makes a square. So for the very first time, when you get to week 5 of any of our cycles, Nature 5, Ritual 5, Myth 5, Symbol 5, that's the point at which the first indication of a matrix of that particular development phase is available. We introduce the phase so that Nature 1 introduces Nature, but Nature 5 introduces the matrix capacity of Nature. So Myth 5 will have a relationship to Myth 1 similar to the relationship of Nature 1 and Nature 5, of Ritual 1 and Ritual 5. So that as your education builds, you can use it as a navigating template to begin to explore structural relationalities in universal phases of development. These phases and their sequence are like the structure of DNA. It's like having discovered what is the sequence by which unfoldment happens. And once one knows that sequence and follows it and gives it a structural quality, you can explore it forever. And you're not ever exposed to some kind of doctrinaire sand trap mentality, because the whole development of thought, the whole development of ideation comes very late, comes at the end of the first year, a whole year of development and sensitization before that even happens. It precludes the possibility of somebody being propagandized into a powerful ideology, which is the disease of mishistorical man. We are sick to death of delusional ideologies and their effects. We're simply crammed full. And we not only have the diseases, but we have the antibodies, and we're a mess. One of the few ways out of that is to go back through that whole development with an attentiveness and a sensitivity and a sensitizing attentiveness that grows and unfolds and develops in a way consistent with the way that the universe works. How does the universe work? It works by integration and differentiation. These two processes, it's like a yoga of breathing in and breathing out. It's the way that it happens. Absorption and emission. They're universal qualities of matter, of energy, of the relationalities between matter and energy. Absorption and emission. If one takes a spectrum of a star in an astronomy exercise, you have emission lines and you have absorption lines. And by knowing the calibration of them, you can tell what elements are present in that particular star spectrum. You can find out a lot about the universe just simply by knowing what the calibration of the rainbow of the real is. And so one can use this kind of education and trust it because it has a built-in algorithmic self-correcting capacity. You can relearn and relearn until you run it through to your own satisfaction that you understand in your way, to your satisfaction, how these processes and how these objective phases work and how they work together and the gestalts that are made. It says, in the very beginning, on the cover, it says what the objective is. It's a quotation from a letter of Thomas Jefferson to James Madison, December 20th, 1787. Jefferson was in Paris, dining the people who would make the French Revolution and trying to encourage them to have, go ahead and do it. And Madison was at the Constitutional Convention, hearing the cacophony of ideational misunderstanding already tearing at the great idea that someone could have a declaration of universal freedom for human beings. And so Jefferson wrote to Madison, encouraging him like he was encouraging the French revolutionaries. Let's try it. Let's see what a new man looks like. Let's start with year zero. So Jefferson, writing to Madison to help him, help the younger man, remind him what's important here is not that brilliant thinkers come up with the right idea and then make people follow that. He says, above all things, I hope education of the common people will be attended to, convinced that on their good sense, we may rely with the most security for the preservation of a due degree of liberty. If there's not a sensitive population to float the entire life process, then there are going to be no forms worth speaking about whatsoever, much less trustworthy, to carry us into all the adventures that we're capable of. If one looks with a visionary eye, one sees that men and women are barely out of the cave, and that we are capable of adventures that are unbelievable, they're unimaginable. And there's only one transformational step away from that whole universal field of exploration, that whole bouquet of possibility. And that is to bring this particular generation out of a delusional sickness of history gone mad into a possibility of living in a realistic cosmos that allows for unlimited adventure. The transformational grammar of that change is not in any political system or ideological doctrine, no matter how complex and refined. It's in an education of openness. It's in exactly what Jefferson said to Madison. It has to be available. It doesn't have to be perfected by anyone in particular, but available to the general population so they may sensitize themselves. And together, men and women, generally, given a reasonable modicum of improvable technique and the space to practice it, will do so. At Myth 4, where we are now, we're at the interface where the first month of myth is giving over to the second month of myth. Each one of these developmental phases, nature, ritual, myth, has a 12-part or a 3-month cycle. There's a beginning, a middle, and an end. So there's a storyline to each one of them. The twist, the first twist in the storyline is in the 5th week. It's like the quintessence of that particular line of development is in the fifth week, next week for math. Why? Because it's the first time that you get a pair of pairs juxtaposed to make a matrix for that particular structure. For instance, let's look at a matrix that came out of ritual and developed itself into a new matrix in mythology. We talked about how Neolithic men and women were different from Paleolithic men and women in that they tamed nature. Paleolithic men and women, in order to live in nature qua nature, left it alone. They liked wild things to stay wild. They followed the animals and followed the plants in the way in which animals and plants lived. But Neolithic men and women tamed the animals, tamed the plants. So animal husbandry and agriculture came in together. They're part of a gestalt of the Neolithic. And just as they tamed and changed, selected and evolved and changed plants and animals, so too did they for minerals and metals. So that along with agriculture and animal husbandry, you have another pair, which is pottery and metallurgy. And so the Neolithic is characterized for the very first time. You do not find in the 200,000 plus career of Paleolithic men and women, you do not find metal implements anywhere. You find bones. You find ivory, you do not find metal, you do not find pottery. You don't find tamed animals, you don't find tamed plants. But right away, the seeds are different. The animals are different. There's metal, there's pottery in the graves. Now, it's true that even Neanderthal men and women put flowers around their dead. One of the graves found 200,000 years ago, found from 200,000 years ago, on Mount Carmel in Israel, just above Haifa. A Paleolithic burial from Neanderthal man from about 200,000 BC, the body was surrounded by the fossilized pollen seeds of flowers wreathing the entire body. The outline of the body had been made with flowers. It wasn't that they were not sensitive, but they were different when Neolithic times came, because the taming of plants and animals, the making of pottery, the taming of the earth into ceramic forms, the taming of the rock into the metal ore extracted, copper, the first one. So if one looks at copper smelting, one finds for the very first time the quality of the Neolithic is there. Tamed plants, tamed animals, copper, and pottery. So that this is a matrix. You can put that pair of pairs together. Yes, there are other items that can be mentioned, but if you put those four together in a matrix, you get a very firm, formative read on the way in which that process happened. One can understand that. But the Neolithic itself transformed, partly because it was a transformational matrix. It liked to change things. So it's no wonder that it changed itself, that the Neolithic changed into the symbolic. And when the matrix of the Neolithic is transformed, carried over, but in a transformational symmetry to the symbolic, one gets all of a sudden a very powerful read on what happened. The symbolic comes in with the development of written language about 3000 BC. The Neolithic really is firmly in place by 8,000 BC. In some places, it starts by 10,000 BC. So the Neolithic pure and simple lasted for about 5,000 years and carries over. There's still Neolithic cultures today. Most ritual comportment today is still Neolithic. But the symbolic culture that developed starting about 3000 BC had a different kind of a matrix. The agriculture became refined so that one could say instead of just tamed plants, one had very specialized plants, very high-powered plants that became symbolic. So the agricultural square in the Neolithic matrix, in the symbolic matrix, in that same square, agriculture can be symbolically presented by bread. Bread. Emmer wheat, very refined. Takes several mutations to make emmer wheat. So that bread becomes symbolic of the agricultural quarter of the Neolithic square. Animal husbandry becomes transformed, and that symbolic quarter becomes symbolized by the shepherd. So you have bread and the shepherd, where agricultural and animal husbandry would be. Ceramics, pottery, transform in the symbolic as the cup, the bowl. And when you transform metallurgy into the symbolic, you get something like alchemy. And in alchemy, you get gold. So now if you look at the Neolithic matrix of agricultural, animal husbandry, pottery, and metallurgy, in the symbolic, you get gold and bread and shepherd and cup. And it's only one little mutation to the major arcana of the, to the minor arcana of the tarot deck. All you have to do is the shepherd's staff becomes the staves, the clubs, the gold pentacle, the old hermetic symbol of the star drawn with a single line. The cup, of course, remains the cup, becomes the grail, and one comes very much into understanding that with bread it's harvested by the sai, and the sai becomes very much like an implement like the swords. Slight mutation. So that the symbolic culture does to itself what the Neolithic did to itself in kind. The Neolithic liked to change things, liked to select out, richly select out and tame and make a transformation that way. The symbolic like to change radical transformation. So symbolic cultures always have the capacity for radical change. Not just evolutionary change through patient breeding, but sudden, instantaneous change. And on that level, men and women become conscious of their capacity, not looking back. The Neolithic always looked back. Well, what is nature like? What can we select out? The symbolic looks forward, looks to the future. What do we envision? What do we imagine that we want? Let's make a change that will do that. So you get a turning around. The Greek word for it was metanoia. Metanoia. So that symbolic cultures are always about the metanoia, the turning around. Plato says the turning around happens deep within someone. You turn around inside yourself. And instead of looking to the past, you look to the future. Instead of looking at what was, you look at what could be. Foresight. The old Hermetic saying was that foresight is the porch of the temple of wisdom. Now, once you get into the court of foresight, you're there at the threshold of the temple of wisdom. You're ready to enter. And of course, the structure of the temple of wisdom has a lot of places, including some secret place called the Holy of Holies. So there are all kinds of ins and outs. And a good education sensitizes its people to the entire fascinating range of this double ecology of the real. Why would we take anything less? Now, the matrix of a symbolic essence of the transformation of nature is held in its relational sequence by the myth of the hero. The myth of the hero is that thread that holds that sequence together relationally so the transformation will happen. It's like giving it a pointed direction, a vector. So the hero pioneers the way in which that thread, that vector, that development will happen. And like all things, it's paired. Like all manifest, objectivized happenings, it's paired. The hero can be a terrestrial hero where that development feeds back into human life, or it can be a celestial hero where that hero transcends. A celestial hero goes into heaven. A terrestrial hero comes back to earth. And there are examples of modulating those two together. The Buddha is a celestial hero. Jesus is a modulation of a terrestrial and celestial hero together. Lao Tzu is a celestial hero. He rides off into the Western paradise. But Confucius is a terrestrial hero. He wants to have it recycled back so people use it again and again. The Chinese do not have a combination of celestial and terrestrial hero until Tang Taitsung, the founder of the Tang Dynasty. When one reads the mythology of Tang Taitsung, one finds that he has a journey through the underworld, a journey through hell, journey through the dead, to bring this material back to make life better, but that Tang Taitsung also is some kind of a heroic demigod. Has celestial and terrestrial possibilities. And no wonder that Tang Taitsung is the first Chinese to develop a taste for Nestorian Christianity. He liked the taste of Nestorian Christianity because it had celestial and terrestrial hero combined together, and he recognized that's the taste he wants. And so you find in Chang'an, erected under imperial order of Tang Taitsung, a stela inscribed with the praise for the Christian religion. And not to be outdone, the Japanese, about 300 years later, one of the great developers of Japanese Buddhism, Kukai, came to Chang'an, saw the stela, and had a copy made and took it to Japan, to Mount Hiei. And that Tendai Buddhism is based upon the Western paradise of Nestorian Christianity, which itself was a Jewish sect from Hellenistic times. So you're talking about Tendai Buddhists in Japan who are really good Jews. We're talking about a planetary culture. I mean to tell you about talking about a planetary culture. You see, American language comes in a lot of varieties. Without the planetary culture, we would not have a glimpse of something which is just nascently over the horizon, not yet quite visible yet, and that is of a star system civilization of men and women who inhabit as their turf the entire star system. who hold all the planets and all the moons and all the asteroids of this entire star system as their backyard. And when men and women are large enough to inhabit a star system, that particular unit fits into a flow of a galactic ecology. For the first time, we'll be in some kind of a position to understand what the scale is for an interstellar experience. But we have to get there yet. We haven't saturated the star system yet. We're still fighting over turf of one planet. There are lots of planets. There are over 500 million planets in this galaxy alone. Plenty. Let's hope it isn't like Ray Bradbury had in the Martian Chronicles, where you get the hot dog stand all set up and there's nobody there. The wife says to him in the Martian Chronicles, after the big war on Earth and the planet is obliterated, and the husband has expected all these colonists to come and big trucks are going to be driving through. This is the crossroads of the two major streets on the future Mars. She says to him, it looks like it's going to be an off season. And ask one time, Ray Bradbury in an interview on CBC radio in Canada was asked, why do your stories seem so much like myths? And Bradbury said, they're myths of the future. He said, we have to tell ourselves these stories over and over again so we don't make the mistakes and do choose the trophies. We want to have the right times and avoid the bad times. We have to tell ourselves these myths over and over again, myths of the future, that science fiction is all about future mythology. And that once conscious visionary man gets into this differential thing of using intelligently the patterns of myth, but in a larger, wider differential world, then men and women are going to be more of what they really are. And what are they? What are we? We are jeweled dimension treasures of possibility. Catastrophically great. We're at myth form. We're bringing Inanna and we're bringing the Prolegomena to the study of Greek religion together. Inanna comes, that whole mythology comes from Sumeria, but it comes from a special phase of Sumeria known as Akkad. And the Akkadian phase of Sumerian civilization was at a time when written language had been around for about 700 or 800 years. It was used in a kind of accounting way for so long. It was used to make king lists, simple chronologies, used to keep accounts, economics, ledgers, accountants, ledgers, and chronological lists of rulers. And all of a sudden, one finds a tremendous jump in capacity of written language about the time of Sargon of Akkad, about 2350 BC. One finds a tremendous increase, and the great writer of that period is the daughter of Sargon. We don't know the names of many human beings from that era, but we know her name, Enheduanna, and she wrote the Inanna cycle. And she participated also in the Gilgamesh cycle. Gilgamesh is Inanna's brother. So with the Inanna female cycle and the Gilgamesh male cycle, Sumerian mythology cinches written language into a whole new expressive capacity. A written mythology founds the ability to more rapidly and more completely interiorize the meaning of language. A mythology is meant to interiorize language, and as it interiorizes, it activates by initially generating them and then vivifying them by recontacting them, initially seeds them into generation, and then by recontacting them again and again, energizes and vivifies them so that a whole interior world becomes awakened. And it's that interior world that will be the space that transformation will take language out of its external referent into an inner focus. And when the inner focus is constellated by enough different focuses working as a massive gestalt, one gets the awakening, the interior awakening of the soul. With the proviso that the soul is not something. It's simply a focus of forces. It's like the barycenter. There's nothing needed to be there. It's just that's where the focus is. You say, well, how can that be anything? Well, that's right. It's not a thing, but it's an everything. There's a point at which the rhythm of mythic language penetrates through the symbolic barrier, and when it penetrates through the symbolic barrier, the reference of any image becomes similar. One of the great modern expressions of this was Yevtushenko's great poem on the hydroelectric station in Siberia, Bratsk Station, Bratskaya, Brotherly Station, a hydroelectric station on the Angara River, north of Irkutsk. Yevtushenko is a Siberian, like Yeltsin, raised there. They were sent there in exile, supposed to be a prison. But symbolic man turns a tomb into a womb. He takes the essence of the underworld and melds it with the inner world and makes a transformation. So what was a prison to the grandparents' generation became a land of openness in the Wild West of the grandchildren. And so Yevtushenko looks at Siberia as a place of freedom and experiment. And Bratskaya Station, the hydroelectric station, is chosen as a symbolic focus of all the activity of the people, that they put their effort and their money and their time into building this hydroelectric station, and it in turn gives back to them energy, gives back to them light, electricity. It transforms the flow of the mighty Angara River in through the turbines, the hydroelectric turbines at the base of Bratskaya Station, into electricity, making heat and light for everyone. And Yevtushenko contrasts the hydroelectric station with the ancient Egyptian pyramid, the pyramid that just absorbed human effort and let it stay static for one man, the pharaoh, as opposed to the effort of all the people that was absorbed and transformed and then given back to them many times over. And he has a dialogue between the hydroelectric station and the pyramid. And in the midst of that dialogue, Yevtushenko in the poem goes down into the guts, the bowels of Bratskaya Station, and he comes closer and closer to the turbines. And as he does, the rhythm of the Angara River becomes a waterfall. And suddenly he's aware, and that white sound of the waterfall of this mighty Siberian river, as a white sound, he hears the bass drumming rhythm of the generators. And he suddenly, mystically, wide-eyed, just like an ancient Sumerian priest who learns to see within instead of seeing within, mimicking seeing without. Instead of seeing things within, he sees allness within. And so the eyes are shown owl-wide. And Yevtushenko in Bratsk Station says, in between the continuing fragments of poetic narrative of how he's talking about how beautiful it is that the hydroelectric station is different from the pyramid, all of a sudden, a word which translates as everything creeps in and eventually takes over everything, everything, everything. And then he'll write something about how beautiful it is or how bad the old was, but everything, everything, everything becomes the refrain. And finally, it just dominates everything. And you realize that he's there before this row of dynamos. And what they say to him is over and over again, everything, everything, everything. And he ends with ellipses to show you that it is whatever, everything. It's this kind of a quality where a myth transforms into a symbolic idea, and the idea integrates to a point of visionary radiance. The mystical vision is a resonance of the invisible point of ultimate integration, the vanishing point. No one made better telephone book lists of things than India. And India has even named the vanishing point. They call it the Bindu. The point which vanishes in upon itself. Stephen Hawking said it's a black hole. And that a black hole vanishes everything in upon itself. Light, gravity, everything. And yet, around the interface perimeter of sudden collapse is a radiation, named for Hawking, because he's the first one to mathematically find it. It's called Hawking radiation. That always occurs in paired molecular structures. So these little impossible dancing pairs of radiation happen around the interface perimeter of ultimate collapse of a vanishing point. Hawking radiation is the first indication that reality not only survives but thrives a vanishing point. The rhythm of that survival is the dance of Shiva, by which the whole thing generates in the first place. It takes, though, an education that can, like an Archimedean screw, get back into the rhythm of making the threads continuous and penetrating with that into a field of inquiry. By that process, one generates and brings out everything that is there. The pattern goes back to Paleolithic hunters. If you are hunting in an unknown landscape and you need to find out where you are, what is the coordinate of where you are? You're not thinking of a map. You're not thinking of towns. There's no such things. They're not useful anyway. The only meaningful identification or location is a better word. The only meaningful location is where are you vis-a-vis the game? And a hunter in an old Paleolithic form of exploration starts from wherever he is and makes a sachet left and comes back to the starting place, then makes a sachet right and comes back and keeps expanding these sachets. And eventually in this butterfly effect, out of chaos, generates by this simple algorithm an understanding of the entire landscape in terms of coordinated of the presence that he began with. This education works the same way. It's like an old Paleolithic hunting technique. We're hunting ultimate wisdom. And we're doing it with the relentlessness of the successful hunter. Whatever the game is, in whatever landscape it is, or whatever landscape within whatever game theory it is, can be either way, we'll find it. In Hunt for Red October, a character played by Scott Glenn looks at his black man who follows the little pings, and he says, "Well, Jonesy, if I can get you close enough, can you track this sucker?" He says, "I can bag him, Chief." Because he's learned to hear out of the whole cacophony of the ocean, the one sound that he needs to follow, even though it was a sound he had never heard before. And he can follow it because, never having heard it before, it becomes eminently distinctive vis-a-vis the natural tapestry. Paradoxically, the conscious, intelligent yogi can follow the unknown better than he can follow the known. He, like Tong Tai Tsung, has the taste for something different and can follow the unknown wherever it goes, especially if it goes someplace unknown. So that conscious men and women are not only at home in the universe, they live there by their own nature, by their own ritual comportment, by their own mythological interiorization, by their own symbolic realization. Wherever it is that they are there, and that is home. We'll come back next week, but I want to talk about here for just a second. Remember the pair of pairs. Remember the way in which this structure is a matrix. The previous matrix that we were working with is from Ritual to Romance and Basho's Narrow Road to the Deep North with Inanna and Jane Ellen Harrison. We're going to let this pair subside for a while, and we're going to bring a new pair, which means that this pair has to turn itself around. That the new matrix is going to be Sir Gawain and the Green Knight with Patterns of Culture, Ruth Benedict and Jane Ellen Harrison with Inanna and Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. What's interesting here is that three of these four are women. Just as in the previous matrix, three of these four were women. Jesse Weston, Jane Ellen Harrison, and Inanna. Just because the women live several millennia apart doesn't mean that they're still not girls. So the only male in this quaternary was Basho. The only male in this quaternary is going to be Sir Gawain. So if we're looking for a discovery mode for the transition from this matrix to this one, we could follow Basho and Sir Gawain as mythological heroes. In a way, Basho is the transformation of the samurai. Basho's forebears were all samurai. Basho was a samurai with words. Sir Gawain is a knight, but he's the primordial knight who follows for the grail, who follows for the unknown, who follows for the mystery. Gawain is a sun-oriented, a solar-oriented knight, whose symbol is the star, the five-pointed star, the pentacle of gold against a blood-crimson background. The symbolic gold star that glitters into reality against the matrix of blood, and blood remains red only when it's oxidized. Oxidized blood is red. Unoxidized blood is blue. It's different. And so in this kind of artery of the life process, there is a gold star that alchemically is available there. Gawain's livery as a knight is that symbolism. So there is something about the quintessential, the five-phase quality of Gawain. But the five-phase quality links up with a language based in threes. Every line of the mid-English poem, Sir Gawain and the Green Light, has triple alliteration. Triple alliteration. And so one has to read this not as the product of medieval Englishmen, if For God's sakes, what's more boring than medieval Englishmen? Well, it turns out that in the Midlands of medieval Mid-England was a very sophisticated and rare phase of civilization. Sir Gawain and the Green Knight occurs at the same time that the Cloud of Unknowing is written, a Middle English Upanishad. It occurs at the same time that Chaucer lived and wrote. And so Middle English, usually if you're introduced to Middle English, you're introduced to Chaucer. A course on Chaucer in a university introduces you to Middle English. The essence of Chaucer, he says about himself in triple alliteration, that he's all about a fair field full of folk. He's about human character. Sir Gawain and the Green Knight is about the symbolic essence of our human character. What is that symbolic essence? That it's able to transform. That out of an impossible impasse, something new will come that allows for life to happen in a completely new direction, completely new way. Sir Gawain and the Green Knight is about the transformation of character symbolically, just as Basho is about the transformation of language in its symbolic way. Language and character transformation. So these two matrices, founded upon three corners by women, two of the corners remaining the same, in Anna and Jane Ellen Harrison. The two women that change are Jessie L. Weston and Ruth Benedict. We move from ritual to romance to patterns of culture. So we have another indexing, another transformational trigger, and we can follow that, and we will. We go from the rituals that led to the development of Grail mythology to the way in which interpenetrating triad of cultures produced a symbolic understanding of mankind in the mythic mode. I know the cameras are finished and the tapes are finished. Let me just say one thing here. Out of this whole generation of women anthropological geniuses, most of them American, not only was there the example of their teacher, Franz Boas, who brought a German intellectual excellence into this curriculum, but they were also heavily influenced by two other men. One was Sir James George Frazer, whose Golden Bough in 13 volumes was like the massive spectrum of the mythological capacities of mankind. It was the first time that someone who was a polymath of cultures spread out the entire banquet of mankind's mythic capacity. So that this generation of women looking at that could see many of the same kinds of implements are served in these different settings. What does that mean? And at the same time as Boas and Frazer were contributing, a third man named Malinowski, Branislaw Malinowski, had an unusual experience. He was a German anthropologist spending time in the Trobriand Islands when the First World War broke out, and he simply couldn't leave. There were no ships that came to get him, and they left him there for 4 years. And when they came back, Malinowski, in a very deep way, had gone native. He became a Trobriand Islander with all the intelligence and background of a great European thinker. Someone who had read Delthy and Hegel and all these other individuals, and he began to understand these people were not primitive at all. These people were primordial. And those men and women, because they were paleolithically primordial, were intelligent in a way that Europeans who thought Neolithic was old had forgotten about. That under the Neolithic substructure of the Western symbolic psyche is a Paleolithic intelligence, very comprehensive. Let's face it, the Neolithic was only about 10,000, 12,000 years at the most. Paleolithic men and women have been around for hundreds of thousands of years. Those responses are really refined. You talk about the Zen karate of courage, you have to talk about Paleolithic men and women. They got it to the nth degree. They understood that realm of the real so well that their very bones and blood were made out of it. And Malinowski was the first person to wake up to the fact that these were not superstitious, primitive, stupid people, that he was investigating from a superior angle, but that he was one of them, and that he discovered there was a whole realm that nobody had ever talked about. Women like Ruth Benedict and Gladys Reichardt understood that they had to get with the people. They had to join the people. And so you find someone like Ruth Benedict, who could have put on earrings and heels and flashed herself. She's down living with the Zuni Indians to become Zuni. Yeah, it makes all the difference in the world. Because if you're looking for a synthesizing gestalt that can really transform, you have to participate. And if you participate, all the magic comes into play. Advertisement's over.